Well, we're getting into the prime time for contracting Lyme disease and the rare but dangerous fungal infection, blastomycosis, and talk with our guest about how to protect yourself and what treatments are available. With us, Dr. Gregory Gaudier, an infectious disease physician at UW Health and associate professor in the Department of Medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. So have you suffered with any of these diseases? I've had blastomycosis. I did not like it. What questions do you have about treatment? I'd love to have you part of the conversation. Join in. Call us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us to ideas at WPR.org. Ideas at WPR.org. I'd love to hear from you. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Greg Gaudier. I really appreciate your time.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me on the show. So very excited to be here.
Just in general, what kinds of organisms cause infectious disease?
So in terms of organisms, we divide them into bacteria, which would be Lyme disease, viruses, fungi, mycobacteria, and parasites. Those are really the big classes of organisms that cause infection. Mm-hmm. And for fungi, it would be blastomycosis.
Yeah. How typically are they transmitted?
So every infection is transmitted a little bit differently. So for blastomycosis, this is a fungal infection of both local and global importance. Especially here in Wisconsin, we have the highest rate of blastomycosis in the country. And for blastomycosis, that is primarily transmitted from the environment to humans or to companion animals such as dogs and less commonly cats. And blastomyces lives in the soil as a mold form, which means if you can visualize a mold form, it's kind of like thin like threads that produce spores, which are little balls. And when soil is disrupted, the spores as well as the mold fragments can get aerosolized into the air. We breathe them into the lungs, and then that can cause infection. And for blastomycosis, it's estimated based on outbreak studies that were conducted here at the University of Wisconsin, conducted here in Wisconsin with much of the work being done by Dr. Bruce Klein at the University of Wisconsin, that about 50% of the people who inhale blastomyces develop symptomatic infection. And so any sort of activity that disrupts soil can increase the risk for blastomycosis, such as construction, home remodeling, excavations, and even doing some outdoor activities such as hunting, camping, fishing, tubing on a river, that can increase the risk for blastomycosis. But blastomycosis or blastomyces is not everywhere in the environment. It likes a certain ecological niche. And that ecological niche is basically forested, sandy soils with an acidic pH in decaying vegetation. And so disruption of that type of soil, which blasto likes to live in, that can then increase the risk for developing blastomycosis. And in terms of Lyme disease, that's transmitted by a tick, the deer tick. And it's also known as the black-legged tick. In medical terms, that's known as Ixodes scapularis. And it requires being having a tick go on you, bite you, and attach for more than 36 to 48 hours for Lyme disease to be transmitted. It's important to note that it's important to note that none of these infections are transmitted human to human or animal to human. So you're not going to get blastomycosis or Lyme disease, from your dog or from another human being.
I picked it up in the northern Wisconsin in the Shawamigan National Forest many years back, and kind of on my hands and knees doing something and in the soil, and that's where I picked it up. So it's not a fun disease at all. We could talk some more about that, but I want to get Katie from Burlington online to talk about Lyme disease, I think. Katie, hi.
Yeah. Hi. It seems like anytime you guys have a show, I always want to learn more about Lyme disease. I want to just say one little thing is that you guys had a show probably like 10 years ago, and I swear it saved my life because it got me to realize I had Lyme disease and I got it treated and I was able to fully recover. But my mom had Lyme disease and she went through the normal 3 weeks of antibiotics and then she's done other things too, like supplements and all this kind of stuff, but she's never been able to get it to fully leave her. And it seems like it's like this heaviness in her brain and it's like a dense feeling. And then she has to really concentrate on thinking. And so I wanted to know if you had any ideas on that.
Well, Katie, thanks for calling. What do you think, Dr. Gaudier?
Yes. So in terms of Lyme disease, after treatment, a small proportion of patients can develop basically post-treatment syndromes in which they continue to have residual symptoms. And in terms of this, usually additional antibiotics for treatment is not warranted. Unfortunately, we really don't have a good explanation with regards to this phenomenon. There's some hypothesis that it could be, related to components of the cell wall of the dead organism kind of residing in tissue. That's some of the hypothesis for some of the kind of ongoing joint symptoms. In general, over time, these symptoms do improve. And sometimes it can take months to years for it to improve. And other times, I think it's important for persons who have been diagnosed and treated with Lyme disease, if they're still continuing symptoms, could there be something else going on as well? So in other words, being evaluated, by a physician, for example, you had mentioned that your mother has had issues with cognitive issues, being evaluated by a neurologist that's experienced in dealing with cognitive issues, because the question is, could there be something else going on? And evaluating for that would also be important as well.
Could be a couple of things going on there.
With your potential.
Yes. Has that potential. Katie, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call very much. And, it brings to mind, the difficulty sometimes I think of being able to diagnose specifically what's going on.
It can be very challenging. So, one of the challenges for diagnosis is thinking about the diagnosis. And also, because if you don't think about it, you're not going to diagnose it. And also, sometimes people can have more than one thing going on, and sometimes there can be two diagnoses, and that can make it very challenging.
Each disease has its own specific signs and symptoms. Maybe we can talk, we're coming up to the top of the hour, but maybe we can talk about some of the general signs and symptoms. As we say, in terms of Lyme disease, it's typically, is there something typical?
Yes. So for Lyme disease, it's divided up into early localized Lyme disease, early disseminated, and late Lyme. And so for the early localized Lyme disease, the classic finding is a skin rash called erythema migrans, which looks like a circle and it slowly enlarges. And it's basically red. It can be slightly warm. Often it's classically described as a bullseye rash where there's a where there's a clearing, but not always. And actually, the most common manifestation of the erythema migrans is actually what we call homogeneous, where it's red throughout and there's no clearing. Sometimes you can actually get increased redness in the middle of it. So there's different presentations of it, and it's important to recognize that. It expands slowly. Generally, it's greater than 5 centimeters, but not always.
We'll take, so that's the first one, and we'll talk about the other two with our guest today, Dr. Greg Gaudier, infectious disease physician at UW Health, associate professor in the Department of Medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And you can join in, you can call right now if you'd like. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with our guest. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking about infectious diseases on the show today. And we're zeroing in on blastomycosis and Lyme disease with our guest, Dr. Greg Gaudier, an infectious disease physician at UW Health. He's an associate professor in the Department of Medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. So, have you had Lyme disease or blasto? What questions do you have about it? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to WPR.org, WPR.org. Love to hear from you. And Dr. Gaudier, we were talking about the three sort of stages of Lyme disease as we broke for news. The first you had described, which was the early localized part where you get a kind of a red circle at the source of the infection. But there are two other stages, and maybe comment on them before we go to the phones.
Yes. So, you have early localized Lyme disease with the erythema migrans, which is the red circle. It may or may not be a bullseye rash. And it's not uncommon for people to have a headache, some fatigue or fever, and muscle aches when they have this particular rash. And then if Lyme disease is not diagnosed and not treated at this time, then people can develop early disseminated disease. Now, if Lyme disease is treated with when there's the erythema migrans present, it will not develop into early disseminated disease. And so early disseminated Lyme disease can have a variety of different symptoms that it can affect a number of different organs. For example, it can cause meningitis. It can cause a cranial nerve palsy. It can also affect the heart, resulting in impaired conduction along the heart, creating heart blocks. It also can cause inflammation of the heart itself. It does not affect the valves, though, of the heart, just the muscle. And in rare cases, when there's arrhythmias associated with Lyme disease, sometimes people need to have pacing done, but that's external pacing. No permanent pacer is needed because it resolves with therapy. Also with early disseminated Lyme, sometimes we can see multiple erythema migrans, which is multiple areas in which there's the rash. And at times we can see involvement of the joints, in which the joints are swollen, tender, hard to move, but they're not usually red, which is a difference compared to infection of a joint from other organisms such as Staphylococcus aureus or Streptococcus. And so that's the early disseminated Lyme. And if they're diagnosed at this stage and properly treated, then Lyme disease is stopped and it will not progress to what we call late Lyme disease. And the most common manifestation of late Lyme disease is musculoskeletal, and that would primarily be arthritis. It can affect many different joints. Typically, it's what we call a monoarthritis where one joint particularly is affected at a time. Most commonly, it's the knee. The attacks of arthritis in which the knee is swollen, warm, but not usually red, that can last anywhere from kind of weeks to months. And if unrecognized, that can eventually lead to joint damage over many, many, many years. But that's currently very rare to have that happen now. Quite uncommon manifestation of late Lyme disease would be neurologic. And usually in the United States, we would see something called Lyme encephalopathy, where there's some subtle cognitive or memory disturbances. There are different Borrelia species, which is the etiologic agent of Lyme disease in Europe. And so Europe can have different, in Europe, there can be different neurologic manifestations.
Let's take a call. And Ken in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, what's on your mind?
Well, I have three questions. I'm wondering if there's a vaccine available for Lyme's disease, if a vaccine could be developed for blastomycosis, and if there is any needed research on blastomycosis.
All right. All good questions, Ken. Thank you for calling. So, a vaccine for Lyme disease. Wouldn't that be a nice thing?
Yeah, so excellent questions. And so there was a vaccine for Lyme disease developed for humans in the late 1990s, but it was discontinued in the early 2000s due to lack of interest and also legal issues with regards to medical legal issues associated with the vaccine. There is still interest in developing a Lyme vaccine for humans, but none is currently available. In terms of blastomycosis, there's been intense interest in developing fungal vaccines. And a lot of work has been done here at the University of Wisconsin, primarily in the lab of Dr. Bruce Klein. And they have developed a live attenuated vaccine for blastomyces. And this live attenuated vaccine is a blastomyces yeast that has a very specific gene deleted called the BAD1 gene that makes it non-pathogenic to mammals. This vaccine has primarily been used to study the immune response to blastomyces, primarily in mice. It is not something that is commercially available or available for humans or for animals. It's primarily used as a research tool, and it has really substantially enhanced our understanding of how the immune system responds to infection with blastomyces.
And Ken's other question, what other research is needed in this area or ongoing?
So in terms of research that is ongoing for blastomycosis, there's both clinical and basic science research. Some of the clinical research is to understand an optimized treatment for blastomycosis in patients who are immunocompromised, such as persons who have received a solid organ transplant, because there are higher rates of severe disease as well as mortality in persons who are immunocompromised with blastomycosis if it's not diagnosed early. There's increased research on kind of a clinical as well as basic science to enhance our diagnostic capacity to diagnose blastomycosis early. The current diagnostics that we have for blastomyces involve obtaining a specimen for staining, and special stains have to be used to identify it. Typical stains that look at bacteria will not see blastomyces. Culture can be done, but it has to be a special culture, a fungal culture, not a regular culture. And it takes 5 to 28 days for blastomyces to grow in culture. Serologic testing, unfortunately, which we look for antibodies against blastomyces, the traditional ways of doing it have not been sensitive or ideal enough. And that would be something called complement fixation or immunodiffusion for those who know diagnostics. There is a new antibody test that's being developed that looks at the immune response to the BAD1 protein, which I had mentioned previously before for the vaccine. And that looks very promising, but it's not commercially available. There are also other research going on to try to determine enhanced diagnostics. And currently, there is an antigen test that you can get out of the urine, the blood, spinal fluid, or fluid obtained from the lung when somebody undergoes a bronchoscopy, which is basically putting a tube down the lung, squirting fluid into the lung, and sucking it back up. And that test is very helpful in the urine. It's going to find blastomyces, 70-80%+ of the time. So it can be very helpful, but it does not eliminate the need to obtain staining and culture. And of course, on the basic science research side, there's continuing ongoing work to optimize how the immune system responds to blastomyces. And so that's ongoing. A lot of that's here at the University of Wisconsin.
So quite a bit going on. And Ken, thank you again for calling. Jim and Stevens Point, it's your turn. Hi, Jim.
Good afternoon. Living in central Wisconsin, I know that blastomycosis is often found in the Wisconsin River Valley and its tributaries. And I'm wondering if it's also found in the soils around or soils that would have been dredged out of the river and how long that might last in the soil.
Mm-hmm.
That is an excellent question. As you mentioned, blastomyces is found in the soil. That's its home. That's where it lives. And in kind of central northern Wisconsin, a lot of the soils are very conducive for the growth of blastomyces. And so there is potential that dredged soil, which would have a lot of nutrients and decayed material that's dredged up, that could potentially be a very nice habitat for blastomyces to thrive in. And kind of integrating the last question, there's also research ongoing to try to best how identify blastomyces in the soil. It's very, very, very difficult to take a soil sample and grow blastomyces out of it, just extraordinarily difficult. And they're trying to develop new molecular techniques, such as PCR, known as polymerase chain reaction, to basically identify the DNA signature of blastomyces from soil samples. And that does look promising. And that potentially in the future could help minimize the risk of outbreak or outbreak exposures if you knew where blastomyces lives. That being said, one of the challenges is that some of the thoughts are that there are certain conditions, environmental conditions, that allow blastomyces to potentially bloom or grow more, and that can increase the risk of exposure and potentially to outbreaks. That's a hypothesis and theory that's not been proven, but there are probably certain environmental conditions, weather, rainfall, et cetera, that can influence it. But we haven't quite figured that out yet. And that's where some of these molecular testing and being able to track blastomyces in the soil could be very helpful. But we're not quite there yet. But that's something that's potentially coming.
Thanks, Jim. Appreciate it. Rita Lynn in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Rita.
Hi. I got Lyme disease in 2012. Went to the doctor on a Friday, son had Lyme disease, had all the symptoms, plus probably a 4 to 5 diameter, 5-inch diameter bullet. He wouldn't treat me and sets up appointments to a dermatologist and a neurologist 2 weeks later. Well, that was a Friday. The following Thursday, I couldn't walk. I couldn't walk from my bedroom to my bathroom. And I was bedridden for a few days. Then the neurologist or the dermatologist wondered why I was there, and then the neurologist treated it. But the problem being that since then I've gotten another attack, and what's happening, they've done biopsies. They find dead muscle cells in my body. Three biopsies that were done, Mayo, Madison. I was just at Madison a few weeks ago, and they just kept my the rheumatologist there shrugged. There's nothing they can do, and I don't know when I'll have another attack.
So what can we do, or what can Ritalin, what's the next step for her? Sounds like a terrible situation.
Yeah, I'm sorry that this has been so challenging, you know, for you. In terms of the lesion, the target or lesion that you describe for Lyme disease, when that is seen, the recommendations are to treat it. You don't need any sort of immediately. Yeah, you don't need diagnostic testing, so you don't need to get blood testing or anything like that at the time. As soon as you see the erythema migrans, which can be target or homogeneous, fully red all the way through, or increased redness in the center, then you can go ahead and treat it with a number of different antibiotics, doxycycline, amoxicillin, cefuroxime. All of those work very, very well to treat it. You really don't need a skin biopsy for that unless there's some diagnostic confusion, but that would be extremely, extremely rare to need that. In terms of Lyme disease, in terms of kind of subsequent attacks, what's been shown, and there was some very elegant studies done, especially one in the New England Journal of Medicine many years ago, in which they found that people who had subsequent episodes of Lyme disease were actually getting reinfected. So it wasn't that the Lyme disease bacteria was persisting in the body and then kind of rearing its ugly head again. These were all new infections. So once somebody's infected with Lyme disease, there's no lifelong immunity to it. You can get it again and again and again when you're exposed to a tick. So each new episode of Lyme disease is associated with a new tick bite and transmitting Lyme disease from the tick to the human.
So if you get it the second time, as it sounds like Ritalin did, will the doxycycline or some of the other medications work, even though the second time around, maybe?
Yes, the antibiotics will work. So far, there's been no documented resistance of the organism that causes Lyme disease, Borrelia burgdorferi, to be resistant to the medications that are used, such as doxycycline, amoxicillin, cefuroxime. So you don't need to worry about drug resistance.
And in Rita's case, she's well past the this,
yeah,
which is really too bad. I'm not sure what else we can tell her at this point.
Yeah, and I'm not aware of Lyme itself causing, you know, the muscle tissue to die. That's just not something I've heard of or aware of.
So she needs to continue to work, maybe seek other medical opinions.
Potentially, yes.
Yeah. Rita, I'm sorry for your problems. I appreciate your call very much, though. Thank you very much for calling. Katie in Pewaukee, your turn. Hi, Katie.
Hi. I'm calling. I'm just curious, what is the best way to detect if somebody has Lyme's disease? My understanding is that frequently the blood is drawn, but oftentimes it comes back negative in most cases, and frequently the person actually has Lyme's disease but doesn't know it, and it is testing as negative. So what's the most accurate test a person can get?
Excellent question. And so in terms of diagnosis of Lyme disease, it really depends on which stage you're in terms of how good the tests are. So in the early stage of Lyme disease, where you have this rash, the erythema migrans, the human body hasn't built up enough antibody response for the test to detect. So that's often why we don't test blood when people have this particular rash, because there haven't been enough antibodies for the test to built up for the test to detect. So at that point, The test is not as sensitive and has the potential to be negative. However, in some of the later stages of Lyme disease, such as early disseminated, if somebody has heart issues or meningitis, the sensitivity of the testing for Lyme disease is very good. It's over 90% of the time we're going to detect it. And similarly with late stage Lyme disease, with the arthritis, or very rarely the Lyme encephalopathy that can be seen with neurologically with late Lyme disease, again, the testing is over 90% positive. And the way Lyme testing is done, it's recommended to do a two-step or a two-tier testing. The classic way of doing it is getting something known as an ELISA or enzyme immune assay. And if that's positive, then you go on to get a Western blot, which looks for, again, antibodies. And there are certain criteria for a Western blot to be positive. In the recently updated guidelines for Lyme disease, they've now recommended that you can get this EIA or ELISA testing, do one first and then confirm it with a second one that looks at a different target. So that's another option. And that's a little bit more sensitive at detecting more early stage Lyme disease than the classic ELISA testing followed by Western blotting. So there's two different ways of testing, but it's always a two-step test that provides the most accurate way of doing it. In terms of molecular testing, such as polymerase chain reaction or PCR, that's not as good for detecting Lyme disease, whether it's in the blood or the spinal fluid. It's best to use it if somebody's looking at joint fluid, but again, that's more of an adjunctive test that can be helpful if there's some diagnostic confusion. But again, that's not a perfect test. But serology, looking at the blood, is really the best way to do it, especially if it's done correctly. It can have high sensitivity, especially when the body has built up enough antibodies against the organism that the test can detect.
And on that note, we're out of time. I want to thank you, Dr. Gaudier, for being with us today. I hope we can do this again sometime down the road.
Yes.
Lots of interest in it. And I appreciate your time very, very much. Our guest, Dr. Gregory Gaudier, an infectious disease physician at UW Health, associate professor in the Department of Medicine at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. So great to have him with us. And I'm just looking ahead to tomorrow. We'll be looking at gardening for wildlife on the program at 11. Then at 11:45, we'll talk about the Wetland Coffee Break series and then hear the latest from the International Crane Foundation. That's tomorrow on the Ideas Network. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening, and please stay with us. There's lots of good things in store on the Ideas Network right through the afternoon. I'm Larry Mueller.